This week on The Futurists, Dr. Alex Zavoronkov.
The percentage of the elderly in the population is increasing very rapidly. So many economies are not sustainable at all. So if we don't fix the problem right now, countries will have to go to wars and, you know, fix it in the old school way that we've experienced before this extended period of peace.
Well, welcome back to The Futurists. I'm Rob Terzic, the co-host, and this week my co-host Brett, who's a traveling man, is calling in from the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. Hey, Brett, what's the weather like down there in Tulum?
Oh, 37 Celsius today, so nice and toasty.
Beautiful, you're soaking up the rays.
Absolutely.
And you were just in Mexico City.
I know this is one of your favorite parts of the world, so yeah, I've been in Mexico City this week. And just decided to get some get out a bit for the weekend, and then next week I'm in Denver, and then I finish the week in Armenia. So the travel continues.
And then I'm going to see you finally in Los Angeles in a couple of weeks. I can't wait for that.
That'll exactly, be yeah, looking forward to that.
It's really cool, Brett. You're traveling the world, finding all the interesting people for our show. So we love you for that.
And we've got a really interesting guest today. If you want to look at the bleeding edge of generative medicine and the use of artificial intelligence in, healthcare, this is the show.
I'm excited for it. You know, this is really great because so many people that I encounter find artificial intelligence frightening or challenging or perplexing or confusing. And in that conversation, we tend to lose sight of the fact that it's actually here to serve us, and it can be a profoundly powerful tool. So this week, we're very pleased to have Dr. Alex Zavoronkov joining us. He is the founder and CEO of InSilico Medicine, which is one of the very first companies in the world using generative AI to do drug discovery and much more. Now, he's also a prolific writer of research. He's authored more than 150 papers. He writes for Fortune magazine as a regular, or sorry, Forbes magazine as a regular correspondent. And he's also an adjunct professor at the Bach Institute. A really distinguished guest for us today. And welcome to the show, Dr. Alex. It's great to have you.
Great to be with you today.
Thank you. We are super curious to understand about InSilico Medicine. If you could tell us a little bit about how the company was organized in 2014 and what your initial objectives were then.
So sure. I guess leading to the company formation, I need to give a little bit of a background. So I'm a computer scientist by training. I did my first two bachelor degrees in computer science, and then worked for a number of semiconductor companies focusing on GPU computing. So it's those are the same chips that are powering AI today. But I was working for a rival company to NVIDIA. I realized that, you know, the biggest problem that I have at some point in time after I made a little bit of money, that, you know, we're aging and dying. And that's the most important process that you need to address in the world, because, all the other risks are out there. There are large risks, but 100% risk of death comes from aging, right? So we're all going to die and lose everything in between. So in 2004, I decided to completely switch my focus on aging, and did my grad work at Johns Hopkins, worked at a number of startups, conferences. And in 2013, I saw that the deep neural networks are becoming so powerful and so versatile, outperforming humans in multiple tasks. And of course, you know, DeepMind played a huge role inspiring all of us with their Atari paper showing deep reinforcement learning and the possibilities. And I thought, well, maybe I should go back to the roots and start working on deep learning for drug discovery. At that time, I was already very familiar with biotechnology, kind of a black belt in drug discovery, personalized medicine, had a lab, and I was going back to the roots, to deep learning. And one of my friends, a very good friend of mine from ATI days, Phil Eisler, invited me to present at the NVIDIA GTC conference. I I thought, well, it's a good idea because I'll be able to talk about how deep learning and GPU can accelerate multiple biological research tasks. So I went to the GTC, presented, and realized that that's you know, that's the time. So that was the time of great deep learning and AI revolution. Started in silico, so went back to Baltimore, established the company at the Emerging Technology Centers and of the Johns Hopkins University, and started focusing originally on predicting human age. So some of our first papers and research projects were in utilizing deep neural networks to predict your chronological age. And it might sound like a silly idea, but that's the way to capture human biology, right? Because we change with time. And imagine that we change the word aging to understanding biology in time, right? From cradle to the grave, right? We change. And
Alex, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm just curious to understand, how can you do that? Because aging happens inside of us, right? It could be our organs, it could be some of our you know, tissues and so forth that are aging. How can an AI understand that? How can it perceive that?
So very simple, just like a human would. So you perceive aging, and we perceive aging at many, many levels, right? So when we're looking at each other, our deep neural network, which is our brain, recognizes where you are in life automatically. We don't even think about it, right? So you can predict somebody's age just by looking at them with very reasonable margin of error within, you know, a few years. I can recognize people within 2 to 3 year accuracy nowadays. And the closer you look, if you get the time to actually observe the areas around the eyes, look at the hair composition, look at, you know, depending on where you look, your accuracy will improve. Sometimes
need for invasive procedures. You don't need a biopsy or anything like that to do this.
Yes. And of course, you know, an experienced surgeon who performed a lot of open heart surgeries would be able to, you know, look at the heart and also classify the patient into certain age groups, right? So if you open up somebody who is 75, the heart might feel like, you know, it's like an eggshell, calcified, would be more yellow. So depending on where you look, you can still predict age. And humans can operate on multiple data types, like visual data, voice. You can recognize age from voice. You can recognize age from feel, right? So touching and feeling. However, or even smell. However, machines can also interpret the data that we cannot perceive ourselves and not understand. Like, for example, gene expression. So the relative amount of each genes that is being read at any point in time in every cell in your body, or proteins, or biological data that is coming from your blood test. So this this data also changes in time, or a retinal scan, or an MRI. So every type of data can be used to predict your age because you are changing in time with certain accuracy. And what deep neural networks can do, they can now predict your age using completely disconnected data, right? So taking a data from your wearable, connecting it to gene expression data, connecting it to your face, and you perfectly understand where you are in life, right? Because your chronological age is the single most important feature defining when you're going to die, right? Because look at today's 95-year-olds, right? You can probably predict how long they're going to live.
Do you foresee a situation in the future where my smartwatch, you know, let's suppose I'm wearing a smartwatch in the gym, and based on the information that it has about me and other people like me, that watch might start to make recommendations to me about my lifestyle to increase my longevity. Do you envision that happening?
Well, it's already happening for several years. So that technology was available for consumers starting 2018. And we've also developed several technologies that allow you to do that. We've spun off a company called Deep Longevity. That company is specializing in biomarkers of aging. But where I'm leading to is that predicting age using multimodal data allows you to understand basic biology and time, and then also correlate this biology with biology of disease, right? So we can now find those breaking points that start leading towards the types of damage that are very pathological, right? So you don't see a lot of Alzheimer's patients in 20-year-olds, right? You don't see a lot of Parkinson's, you don't see a lot of adult cancers. So most of the diseases are age-related, and what deep neural networks allow you to, and already allowed you to in 2014, 2015, is to not only look at lifestyle recommendations for how to live longer, but also to understand where the system breaks and which ones of those switches, molecular switches, we could perturb, we could switch on and off in order to modify the disease trajectory and possibly even aging trajectory. So that's where we started originally. And since we had pretty good understanding of human biology and, you know, pathways, proteins, we could transfer this knowledge into a credible business model where we hunt for those switches, right, that are critical in disease and aging at the same time. And then we develop specific chemical matter for it, chemical molecules that we also imagine using AI to try to modify the disease, to either completely cure it or modulate it into some more benign way so that you ameliorate the process, or you help another drug fight disease better doing combination studies. And all that is possible with AI. And I think we were the first ones to start utilizing aging as the core biological process that you want to teach deep neural networks to understand. Because if they only understand a snippet in time, just like a picture, so if you're looking at a picture, you're looking just at a snapshot of a process in time. If you're looking at a video, and especially video over the entire lifetime, and you are trained on billions of those videos of people over lifetime, you understand what's going to happen, right? And you understand the behavior, the fate, much better than if you are looking at pictures. So we decided to look at those continuous processes. So again, don't classify us directly as an aging research company. We are looking at biology in time.
Yeah. Alex, I mean, we've had these algorithms for a while that can sort of guess your age based on various cues. And it wasn't that long ago that we saw that AI had been able to look at video conferencing, for example, and tell whether there's a likelihood of an Alzheimer's or a Parkinson's diagnosis from just processing visual cues and so forth. But when we talk about biomarkers, and you're talking about protein switches, you know, gene sequencing and so forth, but, we had Aubrey de Grey on the show last year, and, we've had other, you know, Dr. Andrew Hessel and others on. But one of the things that really strikes me is we're getting a lot more sophistication in terms of understanding aging, how telomere length and cell senescence and so forth come into play. So when it comes to sort of this concept of modeling aging, based on sort of these complex biomarkers and so forth, not just the visual indications, theoretically, we should be able to apply various treatments, whether it's gene therapy or whether it's telomerase interventions or ways to flush out dead cells and so forth, where we could change the aging mechanics. But as a model, how do you model a system that's that complex, that you've got so many different components to it?
Very good question. And until deep learning became available and got pretty much consumerized, it was even difficult to explain. So, but now I can do it easier, and I can show many research papers showing how we have done that, and actually real-time tools that allow you to predict age. So as you expose deep neural networks to longitudinal data, so data that is labeled with age. So you, for example, train on pictures or train on many, many blood tests annotated with age, train on Fitbit data, train on gene expression, protein expression data acquired over time in healthy and also people afflicted by disease. Deep neural networks learn the patterns, and they also learn the common patterns between the two several different data types that were previously completely disconnected. How do you connect a picture with a Fitbit data, right? But for a deep neural network, those data types are compatible. So imagine many, many neurons on the input layer and many, many different data types also features from different data types going onto the input. And then you have many, many, many layers of neurons that are interconnected, and you have just one neuron on the output, which is predicting the age. So imagine the structure of a deep neural network like that, but with thousands of neurons on the input that train on previously disconnected data types. So over a lifetime, you can actually train a deep neural network on the individual that will be actually a pretty good copy of the individual, depending on what kind of data you capture. Right, so that's how digital twins can be created. And with generative AIs, if you also hook up this deep neural network that learn the basic features that change in time and as many as possible, you can also now generate synthetic humans into the future with age as a generation condition. Very easy, just think about one thought experiment. Imagine that you give it a template, let's say Brad Pitt or you, and you say, well, now I want to see this person, let's say Brad Pitt, from 70 to 100, and also with Asian features and with glasses, balding, and muscular, right? And maybe a little bit more female. And the deep neural network will be able to create a person like that, and it will actually give you thousands of people like that, billions, if you like. It will give you a distribution of those images where you can sample from and select the best copy of Brad Pitt that you like, right? And different variations. So that is the power of deep neural networks. If
how might that be used?
To a slightly different data types.
Could we use those copies to test things? You know, could we start to use that as like a sample population for testing and experimentation?
Exactly.
Or could you run a simulation?
Drug application. Yeah,
you just nailed it. So now imagine that on those, we give a template, the first kind of picture of Brad Pitt. And instead of a picture, we use gene expression profile. So biological data that us humans cannot interpret easily, but machines interpret it even easier than pictures. And now we mutate one of those genes and then give the system some time to understand what happens with this mutation and where does it lead. So we extrapolate from today, where we made this mutation, to 20 years into the future, or to 5 years into the future, and see if it results in cancer, if it results in Alzheimer's, if it results in Parkinson's or diabetes, right? And now we can also mutate several.
So we're connecting the dots on a sample population, or so that we can see the longitudinal effects, but based on some baselines taken at different samples from different age groups and so forth. So you're basically parsing sort of a generative approach to coming up with how these conditions progress. Because we know now for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, for example, the symptoms of this show up potentially decades before you're actually diagnosed. But by the time you're diagnosed, the damage is done, right?
Exactly. And all of us would get Alzheimer's. We just don't live long enough, right? So the question is, what do you target in order to prevent it for your lifetime? Or if you have it, which ones of those small features that I was talking about mutating, which ones do you select as your primary target for an intervention, right? Because if you have it, you might actually be able to stop it. So that's what we're studying, right? And that's kind of my biggest passion. And what all of you need to understand is that actually modeling the disease and understanding why it happened or how to treat it, it's very simple with AI nowadays. So we have massive numbers of hypotheses, and the problem becomes how do you test, right? So once you've identified the problem in silico, so to speak, in a computer, you need to test it. So validation becomes the biggest bottleneck, right? So where do I test the hypothesis that this particular switch that we've identified using this longitudinal data analysis, does it stop Alzheimer's, right? Does it stop a certain cancer? And that's where in silico begins, right? So then in silico medicine as a company. So once we identify a bunch of those hypotheses and create molecules for treating those switches, so to speak, those proteins that we want to target, we need to see if it works. And what we do, we start with a journey where we take cancer cells or cells from patients afflicted by other diseases, and we expose them to chemicals that we predict to work for that specific disease. And then we look at cells, but that's like, you know, it's like the first date with your future wife, right? This first date might not tell you what it does in the future, right? And you go into animals, right? And that's kind of the second date, right? So you need to show that this same molecule works in a mouse model of a disease, right? And you need to select the right mouse model.
Is this a process that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has authorized for this kind of drug discovery? Is that actually a legal process right now?
Exactly.
Oh, that's really extraordinary. So you can actually do all this in a simulated environment before you start to do human testing?
Yes.
Okay. In a moment, we're going to have to take a break here. So why don't we do that
Absolutely.
Now?
Well, before you go...
Yeah, sure. Why don't you bring us to a conclusion and then we'll take a little break.
So you can simulate all of that in a simulation. However, and again, we are deeply thankful for the aid to the FDA for the guidelines, right? Because before you start human testing, not only you have to demonstrate the results in silico in a computer, you also need to demonstrate multiple case studies where we tested in animals, where you've tested in cells, different models of the disease. So you usually need to perform dozens, if not hundreds, of experiments before the FDA lets you try it in humans, right? Otherwise, we would see a lot of damage being done to innocent, healthy, or patients, humans. We need to do a lot of experimentation in the lab before we go into humans. So the process consists of three parts. First, you do the in silico modeling, so in a computer, in the AI. You get some hypothesis. Then you go into the lab and test it in a variety of disease models, in cells, in mice. And then you go to the FDA and show them what you've done and ask them for permission to start a phase one human clinical trial where we would test safety of the compound in a small cohort of the population. And then you do a phase two study several years later. If your product is safe, you need to show that it's efficacious. And then you do a phase three study where you combine safety and efficacy on a large population. So those studies may take you decades. I'm not kidding. So
yeah,
may
that's
take
right.
you
I,
on. So,
I think yeah. I heard you do a talk where you mentioned that discovering the actual, discovering the medicine is actually pretty quick. It's the testing and the FDA approval process that takes such a long time that adds a delay to the deployment of a new drug.
Exactly. So what we are trying to do at InSilico is to not only speed up and cost down this process, our main objective is to increase the probability of success. And that's where aging research helps a lot as well, because you are trying to find the switch that is going to work for as many people as possible. And once you understand biology and time, and you can target a very large cohort of patients with the same disease, with the same switch, so to speak, because no two patients are the same, right? They're always different. So you are trying to find the switch that is likely to help as many people as possible. And we're looking for targets for proteins that are implicated in aging and disease at the same time. So if you're helping with a disease, you're also maybe also helping a little bit with the aging process as well. And that helps live longer, right? So even for people with a disease. So that's kind of our current hypothesis. And many of the pipeline elements that we have in our therapeutic program a pipeline have this dual purpose capability, including our most important project, which is the TNIC protein that we recently published in Nature Biotechnology.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay, thank you for that, Alex. It's time for us to go to break. We're going to take a short break here. You're listening to The Futurists, and our guest this week is Dr. Alex Zavoronkov, who is the founder and CEO of InSilico Medicine. And he's been telling us a little bit about the origins of that company and the drug discovery and testing process. We'll be back after this break.
Provoke Media is proud to sponsor, produce, and support the Futurist podcast. Provoke.fm is a global podcast network and content creation company with the world's leading fintech podcast and radio show, Breaking Banks. And of course, its spin-off podcasts, Breaking Banks Europe, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific, and the FinTech Five. But we also produce the official Finovate podcast, Tech on Reg, Emerge Everywhere, the podcast of the Financial Health Network, and Next Gen Banker. For information about all our podcasts, go to provoke.fm or check out Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show.
Welcome back to The Futurist. I'm your host, Brett King, and here, of course, with Rob Terstek. Alex, before the break, we were talking a bit about InSilico's work. But from a community perspective, for those of you that are watching this on YouTube and you see the video here, you are also heavily involved in creating some very interesting networks of people, getting researchers and leading thinkers in this space together. Tell us about some of the work that you're doing in terms of creating the longevity community globally.
So sure. Thank you very much for this question, Brett. As you know, aging is a very complex process and involves many, many biological processes working in unison, essentially leading to the damage and death. In order for us to understand it better, we need to get a very multidisciplinary community that works in the same direction where they can discuss the latest and greatest advances within their own individual fields and try to put it into a big picture context. So together with the University of Copenhagen, with Morten Schreiber-Knudsen, we've developed the largest event in aging research and drug discovery happening annually in Copenhagen. At the University of Copenhagen, it's a five-day event, 150 speakers, kind of Oscars for longevity, where we select some of the best scientists around the world that made significant contributions within this year and bring them all together from 26th of August to 30th of August. So it's a five-day event. And you can hear pretty much kind of the old stories, you know, diet, exercise, sleep, do what your mother told you, how do you optimize for longer life. But that's usually a very, very small part of the talks, predominantly geared towards how do we measure these changes when you are doing this, do what your mother told you. However, we look predominantly at frontier technologies like gene therapy, cell therapy. How do you understand what is driving aging? What are the recent advances in drugs and drug repurposing? Looking at very well-known criminals in aging and very, very established processes, established drugs. There are several parallel tracks. And those communities are extremely important because very often people think that they can escape aging by, you know, diet, exercise, sleep. Well, no, because billions and billions of people tried everything so far and have not escaped, right? So you can marginally delay. If you want to make very significant progress, you need to go beyond and work as a community on frontier technologies.
Very cool. And so that's an event that's happening in August of 2024 at the University of Copenhagen. That sounds like a great group of people to get together. What are the fields? What types of disciplines do these experts come from?
Usually it is molecular biology and cell biology. So people from different fields. What happened over the past decade, actually a little bit more of a decade now, about 15 years, there is a very common framework that people use in order to study aging. And that is called hallmarks of aging. are a set of biological processes that are reasonably well defined that are contributing to the aging process and that could be perturbed in order to increase longevity. Things like, you know, stem cell the exhaustion, telomere attrition, extracellular, intracellular communication damage, and many, many others. So we try to organize the conference by the tracks that are related to specific hallmarks of aging. And people from all over the world within those disciplines, they come and present. We also try to bring pharmaceutical companies together, investors and startups. Many of those conferences that are focused on aging, they are only for academics. This one actually brings industry and investors together. We look as a community at what we can do in order to push the field forward in terms of the near-term small molecule or biologic interventions. What can we eat? What can we take as a drug or inject in order to delay or even reverse some of the aging processes? Look at more frontier technologies such as, you know, gene therapy or cell therapy or even organ replacement. Blood transfusions in mice and animals and some of the experiments in humans. And it's an ultra high for credibility conference. So if you are just doing some snake oil, machinations, or something that is not going through human clinical trials officially cannot present there. So this Understood. Is the kind of crowd Understood. That you meet.
And do you believe that computation can be applied to every one of those research areas? It seems to me that all the hard sciences are becoming computational sciences.
Absolutely, yes, and also absolutely no. From one perspective, we all use, you know, Google search, for example, right? Just 25 years ago, it would be a very exotic thing to do. But nowadays, it's propagated. We're all interconnected. We're all in the databases. We're all in National Library of Medicine resources. By the way, deep bow to the U.S. government for creating this resource. So that's the best way to spend shareholder money, taxpayer money. We all are interconnected. We communicate. However, you need to perform the experiments. So every time you make a prediction, every time you get a search result, every time you get a generation, you need to validate. And unlike in other areas of AI where humans can very quickly validate with their own eyes or ears or touch and feel, in areas that are related to drug discovery, the only way to validate is to perform the experiment to see if your system did well. And also you need to use the computational analysis later to see if it performed well. So it's kind of an yin yang. It's, the water and fire. So very often.
Generative AI in media is known to generate hallucinations from time to time. It will give you answers that are simply, they're very persuasive answers. They seem very credible, but they're absolutely delusional. Is that also happening with biochemistry when you apply AI to biochemistry?
Absolutely. It's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge for all of us because the data that you can get from a generative system working on a biological process is something that us humans do not understand well, right? So you cannot really look at the data and say, oh, is it fake or not? Very often you don't even understand what it is. So you need to take this result, put it in the lab and test it. And what I've done at InSilico for this specific purpose is we've built one giant robot consisting of six interconnected rooms where you throw a biological sample and the robots evaluate the sample from every perspective and see if the computational prediction or generation was correct or not, and then automatically punish or reward the AI that created this hypothesis. So you can have this virtuous circle of trial and error in a very high throughput mode. So that accelerates the
process.
Sounds
more like quantum modeling than sort of classical AI, actually.
We can do both. So it's very difficult to train a quantum system. We've tried, and we've recently published, we put on archive a paper on how we can use quantum computing to generate novel molecules. But in the non-quantum realm, we, you know, the process I've described, the process of trial and error, is pretty much standard for training deep neural networks in biology.
Yeah, it sounds like a GAN, like a generative adversarial network.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to take this in a slightly different direction, Alex, given that we are sort of closing in on time and have to wrap up. And, you know, I want to be respectful of your time as well. But it appears to me like, you know, we've got obviously around the world now as populations age, we've got an aging healthcare problem. We've got a healthcare system problem in terms of total costs. You know, the US is an outlier, obviously, because it's twice as expensive as the OECD average for healthcare, but healthcare globally has been increasing in terms of the percentage of GDP it takes. And we've got a lot of stuff here that's going to radically change the way we think about medicine and the costs and so forth. The whole concept of personalized medicine that could be, you know, a compound generated for an individual. This is something that sort of doesn't fit the mass market FDA model right now. There's a lot that's going to change. So, you know, if you were starting from scratch today, first principles, and designing a healthcare system with AI at the heart of it, what would that look like?
Huh. Well, it's a very interesting question because you're absolutely right. The population is aging around the world. Currently, the average life expectancy on the planet, that includes also Africa and Southeast Asia, is around 73 years. Right. So currently in the U.S., average life expectancy is around 77. And, you know, in some developed countries or cities like Singapore and Hong Kong, it might exceed 85. But it's marginal difference. And the percentage of the elderly in the population is increasing very rapidly. So many economies are not sustainable at all. So if we don't fix the problem right now, countries will have to go to wars and, you know, fix it in the old school way that we've experienced before this extended period of peace. So if I were to go back and, you know, redesign the healthcare system, I would, of course, put much more emphasis on biomedical research, right? So instead of spending money on other things like, you know, military or entertainment, right now, the biggest problem that humanity has is the lack of understanding of biological processes and tools we need to prevent disease and cure disease. So just from the resource allocation standpoint, I would try to go and focus on frontier technologies, and that would be my only objective function, right? So currently there is, it's very easy for population to distract themselves with, you know, social media, all of those fun events that are happening on a daily basis, you know, one political party or another, wars. But the most important problem we have is we lack the tools to fix the problem, right? So it's actually, it's easy to discuss how we're going to prevent disease in the population, et cetera, but you are aging and, you know, you're just delaying the problem. So we need to figure out how to introduce new tools and develop and discover new tools to ameliorate the aging problem, to make people live longer without disease. And for that, we need to integrate biomarkers into the healthcare system. So I would introduce lifespan tracking.
So does healthcare become a type of subscription-based service then? Because, you know, the whole secret to these longevity models is going to be regular biomarker testing and then, you know, the application of, you know, generative medicine, gene therapy and so forth. But it would seem to me that you have the best shot at improving long-term healthcare costs by starting at, you know, when you're younger.
Earlier. Yeah.
Exactly. I would introduce those cradle to the grave tracking mechanisms where all your biomarker data is instantaneously collected and analyzed by AI systems, and your health is optimized for long life, health, longevity, and happiness, right? Because we also age on a psychological level, and you know, that makes us actually more happy as we age. But there are many, many ways to also improve mental health utilizing those deep neural networks that are trained on longitudinal data. And as you absolutely correctly mentioned, we need to start with biomarkers, start with tracking. For some people, it would feel uncomfortable. Oh, somebody is tracking my data. But actually, somebody is tracking your data right now anyway. They are just doing it for other purposes rather than extending your life.
I mean, they can have all the data they want if I live longer, dude.
Well, most people do not think this way, actually.
Yeah. Alex, you know, the thing that comes to my mind as I'm listening to you is the notion of hyper-personalized medicine. And my observation, based on what you and Brett were just talking about, is that here in the United States, we say healthcare, we use the term healthcare, but that's not really the service that we're paying for. What we're paying for is sick care. You know, we wait until people get sick and then the whole system goes into effect. And when people are dying, the system really goes into effect and we start to spend tremendous amounts of money. What I'm hearing you say is if you had a personalized system, it would begin much earlier in your life and you would start to take actions that would frankly keep you out of the sick care system for much longer. And it reminds me of a science fiction story. We often talk about science fiction on this show. A science fiction story called The Diamond Age by William Gibson, in which he presented a scenario where a young woman would have a kind of like AI tutor that would grow up with her and know her and be her companion. And as she aged and got older, it would begin to get wiser and start to give her more adult level advice and so forth. Do you envision something like that, hyper-personalized medicine co-pilot that lives with you and grows with you and learns from you and adapts to you and starts to make interventions along the way to keep you healthy?
Absolutely. Well, Diamond Age is the book by Neal Stephenson, right?
And, Stephenson, that's right. Yes.
And the book this young lady had was called Young Lady's Primer.
Yes. The young lady's primer.
Illustrated primer. Yeah.
That was the Diamond Age, wasn't it? That book.
Correct. Yeah, Snow Crash. That's right.
Yeah, beautiful Snow Crash book had elements of some. Yeah,
beautiful book for anyone in this audience to read because it gives you a glimpse of the future. And Neal Stephenson, you know, sometimes you want to live in his mind for a little bit because the best kind of generative system for the future of alternative reality and current reality. But we're actually experiencing something like that already, right? So if you are utilizing an Apple Watch, Google Watch, Samsung Watch, all of those smartware devices, they are monitoring you over time, and you can already configure them to give you real-time and futuristic advice on what to do with your body. And of course, it starts with the first principles of you know, do what your mother told you. We just don't comply usually. We're creative animals, and we're rebels to our own health. However, those primers, when they are taught and trained on very large populations, and you have a centralized system for processing this information, not only it can extend lives of individuals, it also creates a knowledge base for inventing future interventions. Because, you know, right now, if you're looking at many, many people who died over the past, let's say, 10 years, many of them died in vain, right? So they didn't leave the legacy of data for us to analyze and create better products. So an effective healthcare system needs to accumulate this data and make products from this data for the future generations to come, right?
In a way, we're the test subjects for the next generation, you know, and we can try things on this generation. Hopefully that will lead to better results in the future. Now, Alex, how long do you expect to live for? How long do you expect your life to
be? That's a question. Yeah. How long would you like to live?
Well, I am very open about this. So I think that for my life, so I am 46 now, if you count the time in utero, and I'm very optimistic about the future. So all we need currently is relative peace, right? So we need to all advocate for peace. And if there is peace in the world, you should stretch your longevity expectations to something that is reasonable, but at the same time, pushing the boundaries. So I would set it to 150 to 200. And I know that it sounds like a lot, but the oldest human lived to 122 and a half, Sean Calment, if you trust the data. The next longest living was 119. So you shouldn't, and they, you know, she smoked up until she turned 107, and she drank up until the end, right? So it's not exactly the representative of healthy lifestyle. And none of those longest living individuals are, so there is no common pattern that we can clearly observe. But you should expect to live longer than they did, because they were born before the internet. They were born before, some of them were born before the airplanes, right?
It's. I mean, I get where you're going with this. It's just that if we can, it's just granularity of data that we need to be able to know what are the molecular and biological switches we need to flip to be able to get that same condition set. Because when we look at the, as you say, you know, there's it's not necessarily, there may be some behavioral element to it and some dietary element, but I mean, the major cause of this decline is just the mechanics of our biology, right?
Bingo, you nailed it. So you can actually not only replicate the same kind of switchboard, you can make it even better, right? So think of lasting to 200, right? And setting that as your goal. In that case, you would need to understand the aging process a little significantly better and go beyond Jean Calment, right? Because you don't want to be frail in the old age. You want to grow old, but still feel and act younger. And to do that, we need more frontier technologies. We need to understand many, many diseases and ensure that we can create tractable and commercially viable business models that allow you to fund this frontier research. That's what we are doing at in silico and within many startups that go to our conference. And often ask this question, you know, how long do you want to live, or how long you're planning to live? And one important aspect when you're asking this question is to know that your longevity expectations will affect your behavior. That is for both of you and for your audience. This is, if you are to take one takeaway from this discussion and you're just listening for fun. So here is the punchline. So the longer you expect to live, the younger you will behave. This is called social-emotional selectivity theory. So if you're better off setting very ambitious longevity expectations for yourself in order for you to act younger, because there is also psychological aging component. And we also published a study on that. So you can use AI to study the change in human psychology during lifetime and see which features make you younger and older. And one single feature that can make you feel younger is optimism. And if you set longevity expectations to as far as possible, to the point where it's believable, right? Because you can actually believe that you're going to live to 150. So far, nobody lived over 122 and a half. With advances in technology, you should expect the gains, right? And you should be contributing to that advances as much as possible, right? Instead of trying to go into, you know, politics, wars, etc., and just getting stuck to the silver screen.
It should be the primary objective of the human species should be longevity and slowing or ending death. And on a second basis, it has to be obviously climate resilience and climate response. You know, but AI hopefully will give us the tools to do justice to both of those things.
Yeah, what I'm hearing on this show is that AI is going to be our constant companion to help us live longer. And, you know, that goes against what a lot of people expect right now. They think AI is a threat, or it's going to steal something, take our jobs, or somehow disempower us. And what you're saying is it's the exact opposite. It's here to help us live longer.
Yeah.
The other thing I just heard you say, Alex, is that old adage, in a way, you're saying, if you believe you can do it, you can. And if you believe you can't do it, you're probably right about that as well. So this is all about optimism and attitude and frame of mind. Alex, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you so very much for sharing us your thoughts about longevity, the future, computational science, and artificial intelligence aiding the drug discovery process. Where can people find out more about you and In Silico Medicine?
So first of all, it's a great starting point is to come to our conference at the University of Copenhagen, so agingpharma.org. If you want to learn a little bit more about what I do, you can go and look at longevitypledge.org. So I'm very focused on longevity. So my objective function is to find solutions for people to live long enough to solve all other problems. To find out about In Silico, go to insilico.com or follow us on Google Scholar. We publish many research papers, and some of them are more general purpose. So it would be great to get more audience to get at the science.
That's a great.
And also you have your series of articles on Forbes as well. I think that's another place where people can find you. Well, great. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. Brett, thanks for dialing in from your travels in the Yucatan.
That's
I hope you get to see
show.
Some of those cities, those Mayan cities. I'm going to thank our producer, Lisbeth Severance, for organizing the show and producing it this week, and the whole crew at Provoke Media that make the show possible. And as always, we thank our fans and listeners and our followers on social media. Thank you for the suggestions. We're always interested in your questions and your suggestions for future guests. Each week on The Futurist, we'll bring you one more person who is using their time on this planet to influence the future that the rest of us will experience. And this week's been a particularly inspiring show, so thank you for that, Alex. And folks, we will see you in the future.
In the future.
Thank you. Let's make the future better.
Well, that's it for The Futurist this week. If you liked the show, we sure hope you did. Please subscribe and share it with the people in your community. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. That really helps other people find the show. And you can ping us anytime on Instagram and Twitter at Futurist Podcast for the folks that you'd like to see on the show or the questions that you'd like us to ask. Thanks for joining. And as always, we'll see you in the future.